Prevail, c'est chez de Genève programme pro politico.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organisé, dinero sucio.
Globale corruption. Ta brutbu za démocratie.
Et ahora,
ATP.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión,
Greg O'Leary.
Greg O'Leary.
Welcome to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg O'Leary. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Rachel Slade is here. Rachel, of course, is the author of Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro, which was a notable book of the year by the New York Times Book Review and a New York Times bestseller. Also, just fantastic book. She's got a new one coming out in November. It's called Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. She's been working on this for a long time. I talked to her privately about it like a year ago, and I've been dying to talk to her about the book and get her back on the podcast to discuss what she'd been researching and writing about. So this is a really fun, engaging conversation. It's about manufacturing and kind of the history of manufacturing in the United States and elsewhere, which is something that, frankly, I just never think about. I just, you know, at one point we're talking about the shirts that I wear on the show, because I wear these shirts by a company called Out of Print, which have book covers on them. And she says, where were those shirts made? And I'm like, oh, you know, I didn't even bother to look. But she bothers to look, and not only bothers to look, really gets into it and gets into the weeds about it. And it's going to be a fantastic book. I'm very excited to read it. We talk about all kinds of things. We talk about kind of the history of U.S. manufacture since the Great War. We talk about the whole made in Japan, the concept of Kaizen, how centers of especially textile and apparel manufacturing change depending on markets because of the sort of moving capital. We talk about unions and how important unions are and how union membership has been decimated in the last like 50 years and stuff like that. And there's a lot of things about unions and union membership that we don't even realize are important and contribute to our society. We talk about that. We talk about Ronald Reagan. We talk about the shift from pensions to 401ks and how it ties people into the markets and how nefarious that is. We talk about work culture. We talk about China. And we talk about Animal House for like 2 minutes, which was not on my intended topics of discussion. But, you know, I can always stop whatever I'm doing to talk about Animal House for any length of time, because she's also apparently seen Animal House as many times as I have. So stick around for that. Rachel's always fantastic. I love talking to her. You're going to love the conversation. This was a week of series finales. Succession is over. Ted Lasso is over. Speaker Kevin McCarthy is over. I don't know. Three big finales. You know, as I'm recording this on Thursday morning at 6 a.m., I'm pretty sure it looks like they're going to pass this bill to expand the debt ceiling or whatever. So the Republican plan to cause global economic collapse, apparently, knock wood, has failed, which it should, because it's nihilistic and awful and beyond irresponsible. And those people should all be ashamed of themselves, including, by the way, the fucking Democrats voting against it. Just sit down. This isn't the time to Bernie Sanders this shit. You know, let's save the global economy, for Christ's sake. Fucking protest votes, ridiculous. I'm happy about that. I never really went too closely into it because I kind of thought that by hook or by crook, they'd figure out some kind of workaround here. I mean, it's in the 14th Amendment. We have to pay the debts. Aaron Rupar's column, the guy Noah that guest writes there sometimes, put it great. Just sort of explain what the debt ceiling is. In a piece he wrote yesterday, the day before, he said it's like if you you know, you put $3 on your credit card and then you pass a bill afterwards saying you're only allowed to pay $2 back. That's basically what McCarthy's trying to do. It makes no fucking sense. If people understood it really, they would know that it makes no fucking sense, and they would be like, who is this jackass? But, you know, the people that are incapable of seeing Kevin McCarthy as a complete jackass, I don't know. I don't know what to say about those people at this point. Matt Gaetz, who was, the leader of the kind of insurrectionist group of Republicans vis-a-vis McCarthy's speakership, as we recall, it took 15 votes to vote this asshole in. He's now pissed off. So we'll see if this thing lasts or if he's able to endure for another season. As for the other two shows, Succession, I thought, you know, that was a great landing. I think they, you know, they stuck the landing, as they say in gymnastics. I'm not going to say what happened on the show, but I will say that as someone who watched it and sort of obsessed over it for a long time now, I'm satisfied by the ending. I thought this season had its valleys, definitely. There was some lulls in the action in the middle after Logan died, but the last couple episodes, I think, really rose to the occasion, and I've just enjoyed the hell out of the show. You know, it's been great, and, you know, it's definitely one of those shows. It goes in the pantheon of great shows, along with The Wire, Breaking Bad, Sopranos, Mad Men, whatever, Deadwood, you know, which Brian Cox is also in, by the way. So, also, Ted Lasso ended, and, you know, I think it's getting a lot of guff, Ted Lasso is, because it was sort of, I guess, sappy, people are saying. Look, I don't need... Every fucking show doesn't need to be full of, like, weird suspense and plot twists and fucking bad juju all the time. You know, it's okay to make a show about happy people finding happiness and getting over their problems and pulling together and all that kind of stuff. You know, that's part of humanity too, guys. Ted Lasso is a comedy in the strict Shakespearean sense of the word. It ends with a wedding. I don't know if it's the very last shot, but you'll see there's a wedding there at the end. That's fantastic. And, you know, I really enjoyed this season. My fucking adrenal glands are shot, man. I don't need any more like weird suspense and violence and all this stuff from my TV watching. Sometimes it's nice to just watch something that isn't like that. And the show isn't intended to be like that. For what it is, for the intended purpose of that show, Ted Lasso is a fucking A+. And that ending was an A fucking plus for what it is. It's not aspiring to be the same thing that Succession is. But for what it is, it's not possible for it to be better. You know, I did not enjoy Keeley and Jack this season. I thought that subplot was stupid. Otherwise, I liked pretty much everything else that they did. Everything. I mean, it was just great. I liked all the auxiliary characters. Every time they introduced a new person on Ted Lasso, for 30 seconds, that person managed to do something that was memorable or funny or whatever. And it's great that, you know, and unlike Succession, where they're just first they're in the boardroom and then they're in the wedding and then they're in the funeral and then they're always together all the time in this sort of incestuous, you know, it's like a Sartre play, No Exit, where they can't get out of each other's grasp. And it's basically a stage play in very, very exotic, pretty locales, right? You know, Ted Lasso doesn't have those rules. We're allowed to, like, go home with Rebecca and see where Sam's restaurant's like. And, you know, there's Ted and his mom drinking in the... Like, it's nice to be able to deviate away from the workplace and see how people actually live, because it helps round out their characters. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. And because we're in the simulation, and this is something my wife pointed out that I didn't even know, because she's such a good actress... Rebecca on Ted Lasso has the same mom as Kendall and Roman and Shiv Roy. Yeah. So there is some overlap. There's a little bit of overlap on this Venn diagram between these two shows that both ended this week. Basketball is ending. Man, and the writer's strike means that there's not a lot of new things coming. We're going to be in a desert now of stuff. But you know, like I said, I really enjoyed Ted Lasso a lot. The Succession finale was great. And, you know, we'll see what happens with this Speaker McCarthy thing. Adieu, buddy. Fucking such a dumbass. The picture of him at Mar-a-Lago kissing Trump's ring like a few weeks after the insurrection. I mean, really, in any other society. But, you know, here we are. No wonder I need my Ted Lasso, man. I don't wonder I need it. You know, We can't be goldfish all the time, dude. We got to remember all this terrible stuff, or else the bad guys are going to get away with it. All right. I went on way too long. Great conversation with Rachel Slade. One of my favorites. So, I'm going to stop the prattle now. We'll be right back with Rachel Slade.
Hey,
can happen to anyone. Oh, we see something on social media, a meme or a TikTok, and it confirms a false narrative that we believe, like that the 2020 election was stolen or that Elon Musk is a genius. I know it can happen because it happened to me. Hi, I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I only recently discovered that all that anti-vax stuff was Russian propaganda designed to make us sicker, weaker, and more divided. It was an op, and I fell for it. Twice. I knew I had a problem, so I went to a meeting of UIA, Useful Idiots Anonymous, and it changed my life. How can you tell if you're a useful idiot? Maybe you're fluffing Viktor Orban or Roger Waters. Maybe you're hosting Twitter spaces with Nazis. Maybe you recently defected to Russia because you're butthurt that everyone called bullshit on your accusation. Maybe you're trying to primary Biden. If you think you might be a useful idiot, call 1-800-GRU-FOOL or check out our page on Truth Social. Useful Idiots Anonymous, because the first step in solving a problem is admitting you have one. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and I'm a useful idiot. And now, back to the show. Rachel Slade, welcome back to Prevail.
Hello, hello. It's so great to be here.
It's so nice to see you. You've been like locked away in a garret room working on a book, which is called Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. So at one point, I have known about this book for a long time now. And one of the thrusts of it, I think, wasn't the title going to be American Hoodie at one point?
It was. But the problem was that they started shopping that around the U.S., our publishing sales team. And it had too much association with possibly racial violence or police violence.
Yeah.
So, and that's not what this book is about. So they decided to make things simpler. I actually like the double entendre. Or the double meaning, making it in America.
And yeah, I think it's America. Good. I think it's a good title. I wanted you to know Thank that you. This hoodie that I have on is one of those. It's one of those hoodies. It is. I bought it when I talked to you last time about this, and you told me the name, and I have this hoodie.
Yeah. Greg, you are an American hero.
I am.
You are an American hero. So we were talking about your T-shirt, which is this company that prints book covers on it, and I was going to ask you where it was made.
I don't know. It's the company is Go Figure in Brooklyn, which, you know, but I don't know if the shirts are made in Brooklyn. I cannot speak to that. But
so you don't look.
I don't look. I should probably look, you know.
Yeah.
So
you should look.
I can't look now without taking my shirt off. But
because that's what started it for me.
Okay.
You know, that's what started this journey is that ever since I was very, very young, I was like a tag freak, a label freak. Okay. I loved finding out where things were from, where things were made, you know, and then imagine who made them. And so I was born in, I'm just going to say this now, everybody will know, I was born in 69. I've lived in 7 decades. Is that right? But I'm actually not that old, but, right. We're not that old.
You're the same age as my wife and many other people that I know. So there.
Therefore not old.
No.
Although we're both sporting this fabulous now crown of gray hair.
Oh yeah. We have great, nobody can see this, which is too bad, but we have lovely gray hair.
I've had gray hair
for a long time. It's not, you know, I've had gray hair.
So have I. I just was taking care of it for a while, But when I was really little, I was obsessed with these labels and tags. And I remember when I was very little, I have no idea how old I was, but I was old enough to read, but not old enough to really do anything else.
Okay.
And my grandmother came home from a trip to Israel and she handed me a doll. And I take this doll and I'm holding it in my hands. I'm like examining it and flipping it over because I'm a little bit of an asshole. And I find a label on it that says made in Japan. And no filter, truth teller, Rachel Slade, I immediately said, wait, how did a doll in Israel get made in Japan? And then, of course, my mom was like, oh, we're just going to, you know, nicely escort Rachel out of the room. But, you know, it was that kind of thing where it was a disconnect for me. I was also one of those really dumb people. I did not come from a sports family, but I was like one of those people who thought that like sports teams, the players who played on those teams came from those cities. So like if you were rooting for the Phillies, then you were rooting for Philadelphians.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Even though, as Jerry Seinfeld liked to say, it's just laundry. We're just rooting for laundry. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, I just always had a sense of place that we are here and therefore we make our things and, you know, we populate our sports teams. And so the idea of then growing up, NAFTA happens. A lot of outsourcing starts to happen, obviously, in the 80s, but then really kicks in the 90s. And then suddenly, you know, you're in a gap. Anybody remember Gap? You're in a gap because...
Into the gap.
Right? That was my adult awakening. And you're like sifting through these t-shirts, these stacks of t-shirts. And like in one stack, you might have three different countries represented. And if you start paying attention, you will see how those countries change, right? So at one point, it was China, right? And then it became Bangladesh and Vietnam and Cambodia, you'll see a lot now. And so those countries that are making our clothes and all of our goods continually change. Like this is a moving capital, right? Capital is free and it just keeps moving to wherever it can find the cheapest labor. So that's why that started, that kind of triggered this whole thing. And I wanted to understand, first of all, is that a bad thing? And then what are people doing about it? What does it mean to try to make things in America?
We talked about this sort of off the record, not being recorded, probably a year ago, I feel like. And it's very fascinating because, and your stuff always does this. Your brain goes in places that my brain would not even think to go, which I think is so interesting. Like just that, you know, you're looking at the labels, like if I look at a label, I'll think about the country, but not in the same way that you do, in terms of the larger process of how all this stuff works. Right. Like, and that there is some kind of logic to it, not just the cheapest, you know, places to get the labor, but also that on some level we want to reward maybe the certain countries for being on the team and not others.
Yeah, there is definitely a lot of politics in that. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I can't speak for you, but you know, I'm always looking for systems. I'm always looking to understand kind of the larger forces that are ending up in my, you know, that are dictating what ends up in my closet. Or what ends up in on my plate, on my table. You know what I mean? So like, I much to probably the frustration of half the people who read my books who are just like, be linear.
But there is a linearity to it. Like I think you do, you know, I don't think you're not linear. I think you just, you're expansive in the way that everything falls together. And I think for something like trade, and these are things that you're interested in, like trade, manufacturing, logistics, shipping. These are vast enterprises that require lots of different moving parts, and it takes a certain kind of brain to be able to process that, which mind is not, it just doesn't operate that way.
I'm either expansive or I'm really good at making up unifying theories that bear no basis in reality, but that's cool.
It's fine. Your story about the doll from Japan that was from Israel reminds me, my grandparents came back from, they went to Rome, I think, and they came back with these forks that were Italian forks, and they were the ones that were the Italian forks were better because they were like the tines were sharper and you could jab the the ziti better, and there were only I think four of them, so we always wanted the Italian fork. And I remember one day I turned the Italian fork over and it said right on it, made in USA. So.
Wow, that's weird. Yeah. So when would that have been?
I don't know. It was probably.
I mean, how many decades ago?
It was right? In the 70s, I think. Maybe even. Jeez. It may have bought them earlier than that even. But Like, this isn't even an Italian fork that we've been calling an Italian fork.
Well, that's really fascinating. And, you know, the reason I asked about the decade was because, you know, it did take the Italians around a long time to get their manufacturing together after World War II and everything else that happened to them. So the idea that the Italians would be importing American goods, that had to have been a rather long time ago.
Yeah, this was a long time ago. This was quite a long time ago. But okay, so you talked about the war, meaning World War II, and this post-war period. And I feel like some of the story of this sort of begins there to some degree, because, you know, we have a situation where we have Japan in the Pacific and we mm-hmm. have, you know, Germany in Europe, and we don't want something to happen that happened at the end of the First World War, which is we're just like, fuck these people. Let's starve them to oblivion, because we saw that, you know, what happened, and it didn't work out very well with Germany after the First World War. The reparations they had to pay in hard currency basically indirectly led to the rise of Hitler, which, you know, bad. So I think after the Second World War, we said, we're not going to let that happen. We have to figure out ways to get these two massive industrialized countries back into the fold. Mm. And I feel like that's part of where the story begins in your book, or am I totally off base?
Oh, no. Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, okay. You know, all of Europe and Japan were devastated, and their industrial centers were devastated, and they were in trouble. And so, you know, I mean, the real problem was that we were just beginning to see the Cold War. And so the question was, who's going to be exporting what to whom, right? Mm. So because we had beefed up, actually during World War I is when we really started beefing up our exports, and then super beefed up during World War II. I mean, we were just a manufacturing powerhouse. We had like finally figured it out. It actually had taken us a long time. I mean, we were fairly good at making things for ourselves, but the idea of like actually having a robust export economy was like a new thing in World War I. I don't know if you remember, but because I have written about this, but you know, we didn't have any ships. Yeah. To export things during World War I, and our infrastructure, we didn't have a highway system, obviously, that came much yep. later, but also our railroads were kind of a mess, because they had all been developed by various, you know, industrials, various entrepreneurs. They had different gauges.
Yeah,
you know,
they're not uniform.
No, they weren't uniform at all. And where they went was oftentimes at the whim of, you know, whoever was politically powerful at that time. And so it was really a patchwork of a system of logistics,
yeah.
which becomes really, really important when you're trying to prepare for war. Like, that is the limiting factor. So the fact that the United States could actually pull it together and pull together an army and go over to Europe was a miracle. Now I'm talking about World War I.
Yeah.
It was an absolute miracle, but it taught Americans a lot of things about who they could be, what they could be, and maybe why they should think that this was an important thing to do. So I just wanted to lay that groundwork, because, you know, we freaking forget about World War I. It's just that thing that kind of happened. The British act like they own World War I. I don't know if you know, but, you know, when you go there in November, everybody's wearing a little poppy, a little... Yep. Felt poppy, right? So they really act like they own World War I. And I mean, I'm sure somebody British can explain to me why, but I mean, it was that last year was an American war. I mean, it was a French war. It was a British war. Obviously, it was a German war. But I mean, that was the turning point for America. And we were like, okay, we're going to be a superpower. We're going to make things, and we're going to figure out how to get them out of here. And we're going to integrate ourselves into the American, into the global economy, so then we can start to shape the world in our image. So World War I is very important. World War II, we get to put all of that into practice, like for reals. And then the Cold War. So, you know, I think that it was very clear at the end of World War II, I know a lot of people felt this way, that Stalin was a scary dude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe I'm not telling you anything new, but I think there was tremendous fear since the Bolshevik Revolution of what was in 1918 that there was something really freaky about them Russians and their politics and their intentions. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit the way we feel about China now, but we'll talk about China in a minute. But so I really believe that building up Japanese manufacturing, rebuilding manufacturing abroad in general, was a way to start to lay down those very important political connections in a way that could not be broken. So remember, you have GATT. Remember, you have the predecessor to the World Trade Organization. That comes out of World War II also. It's led by the United States. But it's really that Woodrow Wilson belief that if everybody is connected through manufacturing and trade, we will never have another world war, which obviously got disproven in World War II. But
very, 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 very quickly.
We're going to try it again, but this time America has super muscles.
I think the point holds, and we can talk about this later too when we talk about China. Churchill wanted to keep going and finish Stalin off, by the way. And I don't know. Is right.
Really, Patricia was like half dead at that point. He was probably delirious.
He knew what he was talking about with respect to. He didn't like fascist type people. He was not. Yeah. He's not good. He was good about fighting these people.
Remember when Americans didn't like fascists either?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, this is a mystery to me because I feel like, you know, we're about the same age. We grew up. All of the pop culture was like Nazis are bad. They're always the bad guy in every movie. Or every TV, you know, that's just kind of the embodiment of evil. And now we have this whole like movement of people that are like, are they bad? Maybe they're not bad. Actually, Nazis
have some
are cool.
Good ideas.
Yeah,
they're like, you know, pretty good people on both sides.
Yeah, they're people on both sides. You know, in America, the trains were ran on different gauges, but in Italy, the trains ran on time. You know, this kind of thing, and it's like, what the fuck are you people talking about? It doesn't make any sense to me. Other than as in. Some sort of op or whatever. By the way, in Britain, and I read this in one of the James Bond books, they refer to World War One, the old school's British guys, as the 1418 war. That's what they called it after, which I think is downplays it.
The 1418?
Yeah, it's what the 1418 war. 1914 and 1918. You know, like it's the 1418 war. Yeah.
Oh, that's weird.
As if it was some little blip in the, you know.
And speaking of Churchill, you know, it was during World War One when he made a huge tactical error in Gallipoli.
Yeah.
He was responsible for an astounding amount of death.
Yeah.
During World War One. Oh my God. So many heroes, quote unquote, came out of World War One who then, you know, steered us through World War Two. So strange. And Hitler too.
Yeah.
You know, he was, I'm not saying he's a hero, obviously, but I mean, he was a fighter in World War One. And he learned many, many lessons doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the grievance narrative.
Well, the grievance narrative is always, yeah. So I feel like the first, you were talking earlier about like how the location of the places that do the manufacturing shifts through time. I feel like Japan was like the first one after the war where everything's made in Japan? Because there was a period when that was sort of the center for, you know, cheap things. Oh, it's made in Japan
Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
It's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
Well, remember it was occupied Japan for a while. And actually I found my ex-husband's grandmother gave me her little teacup collection. They were like espresso cups. And there was one that I wanted to keep, but I gave them all back because I'm a good person. But it said made in occupied Japan. What are you laughing about?
I'm laughing at because you're a good person.
I am a good person.
I'm laughing because occupied Japan is so funny.
It's a crazy concept, but actually, so this is a really cool little slice of history here that I have in my book. But yeah, so Japan was devastated. We didn't want them making weapons anymore or anything that could be used against another country. So what we actually did, even before the war was over, was started to rebuild their textile industry. So textile and apparel industry. And again, this is what I'm most interested in because it is the lowest common denominator of manufacturing. And so, when this concept was proposed that we would supply the Japanese with knowledge and looms and all kinds of equipment to restart their textile industry. A lot of the conservative states were like, whoa, wait, hold on. What about us? And the American government ended up making a deal with cotton growers in the South so that they would get paid pretty well for cotton that then was exported to Japan. So this is the beginning of now what we do, which is we grow cotton and then we export it for manufacturing elsewhere, mostly Asia. So that was happening really early on. So the other cool thing that came out of my research was, and maybe you know about this, but have you ever heard of Kaizen?
Kaizen?
Kaizen. So it's a manufacturing philosophy or system.
Okay.
And it's called Kaizen, which is a Japanese word. I'm blanking on exactly the translation, but it was first, I air quotes here, it was first exported to the United States when Toyota started manufacturing cars in the US. And the idea behind Kaizen is it's a complicated system, but generally my understanding is that it's looking at the whole system as a unit. So thereby anybody at any point along that line, that manufacturing line, their input is invaluable. And so how they work, any ideas they might have for speeding up the line or becoming more efficient or whatever it is valuable and important. And so it, in a way, it's kind of leveling. So it takes away, you know, the pyramidal structure of a lot of manufacturing systems, and it works toward, we're all on this together.
Yeah.
Now, the funny thing is that, you know, there was a lot of hand wringing when Toyota first came over here because, oh my God, you know, they're bringing this concept, this Japanese concept to American factories, but Americans are individualists. You know, will it be able to translate to American culture? So there were a lot of books about that and articles about that. But the funny thing is, Kaizen is actually American.
Okay.
So during World War II, as we were building up manufacturing in Japan, one of the things, and manufacturing in the US so that we could build these bombers and Liberty ships and everything super fast, one of the things that the American military did was hire like American manufacturing experts to help get everybody on the same page and grow manufacturing really fast. And so they developed what is now known as Kaizen, a simple system where, you know, just what I described. They send it over to the Japanese. The Japanese are like, this makes a lot of sense. Repackage it, bring it back to the US. And then the Americans are like, whoa. What is this? We can't work this way.
Oh my God. Everything, what goes around comes around, I guess. You know, right? That's what Kaizen means in Japanese. What goes around comes around. But it sounds like that does sound like a good system, because if you're working in a place like that, you feel empowered and you feel valued. And I think, you know, that's what people want when they have jobs. They want to feel like they're valued, like what they're doing is important to the people running the operation. So even if they're not, at least feeling that way is important as a motivating tactic, rather than you are a cog in the machine. If you're not going to work for 20 hours today, you're fired and we'll hire somebody else who can be a cog in the machine or whatever. You know, nobody wants to work like that. That just sucks. So,
well, I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And that's kind of, so my book is based around an actual company that is trying to do manufacturing the right way. And again, what does that mean in the right way? All of their workers are unionized, so they're represented. They have vacation time. They have paid sick leave. They have all kinds of perks or benefits that you would expect to find more at a middle class level rather than at a, you know, lower manufacturing level, especially apparel.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that they're doing this is because they want to prove that it is possible. And what's interesting is, you know, you're talking about being a cog in the machine versus feeling valued.
Right.
And I feel like in any manufacturing system, whether you're manufacturing a magazine or whether you're manufacturing insurance claims or whatever it is,
yeah.
You know, we can all either feel like we are disposable or a cog in the machine, or we can feel valued. So I think it's interesting that, you know, I think it's rather arbitrary that we have decided that there's something about manufacturing that is inhumane or anonymizing. Is that a word?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, though. It's like you're just a faceless drone in this machine of manufacturing where you're sitting there building something tangible. You'd be better served doing SEO at this marketing company. You know, like that's somehow better. Like it's all, you know, what does it matter? Like jobs are jobs. And it's about how it's perceived by society, I think, or by media and all this kind of stuff.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, society, culture, I mean, you know, I'm banging my fist on the desk here. It's like, we have to change. We have to embrace these things. But also consider this, there are a lot of people who really don't want to sit at a desk and stare at a computer.
Yeah.
And they would much prefer to work with their hands or machines. And the idea of creating something tangible feels good.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the day, you know, you've got a pile of hoodies that you can say, I made that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can watch them get packed up and shipped out. And then people wear them. Like, look at you. You're wearing that hoodie that I wrote about. I can't believe it.
I know. I have it. Are we allowed to say the name of the company or no?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. I've been searching for a company to write about 20 years. And I finally found it in Maine. The company is called American Roots. And they are just outside of Portland, Maine. And they are owned by a husband-wife team, believe it or not. And the husband, actually, Ben Waxman, spent a decade organizing workers around the country, mostly in the Rust Belt, for the AFL-CIO. So he really saw what happened. He saw how manufacturing built community. And then he saw how the gutting of manufacturing destroyed community. And that's a story I think most of us know well, but he was right there.
Yeah.
And he understood manufacturing as an incredibly powerful tool in community building, in empowering marginalized communities. But beyond that, politically, it's critical to America's future, or any country's future. But, you know, I'm focused on America because I'm American.
Yeah. So it's American Roots, R-O-O-T-S. That's the name of the company, in case people are listening and curious.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And it's a nice hoodie, man. I've had this hoodie a while now. It's good.
Yeah. So it's all American sourced hoodie. So the cotton obviously is from the United States, and every single part from the zipper to the grommets to the drawstring is sourced from factories in the U.S., which is not easy. It took them a long time to build, you know, reliable sourcing. And then, the hoodie is cut and stitched together in Portland, Maine.
Yeah. It's
pretty
cool.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good stuff. I'm very excited for your book. I can't wait to read it. Talking about it the way back when, I was excited to read it. I'm even more excited to read it now. So, So again, it's called Making It in America, which, as you point out, double entendre, very good. And it's coming out on November 14th, which is the day after my birthday. So, you know.
Hey, happy birthday. You're a Scorpio.
I am. Yeah. Yeah. happy birthday to me. So, okay. So this is a good time to take a little break. We're going to be right back with Rachel Slade.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money. That'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Rachel Slade. For the break, we were talking about American roots. We're talking about you brought up the unions, and this is, I have now just a list of questions and topics to throw at you because I want to pick your brain about certain things and how you see things based on what you've been researching for the last couple of years while you worked on this book. So I'm thinking about unions a lot because obviously the Writers Guild is on strike, and you know, there's my take on unions is that obviously I'm pro-union, but I feel like the societal way that unions are perceived tends to be negative because it's associated with organized crime. It's associated with work slowdown. It's associated with, hey, I need you to do this thing. And somebody being like, I can't do that until 10 o'clock because I'm on my coffee break, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that's not really what it is. And I feel like unions in some way, you know, obviously the future of the economy sort of depends on it, because when you have capital controlled by huge corporations, the only possible ballast and way to or bulwark against that force, something that large and powerful, is a union. Where are unions in the grand scheme of things in the United States right now? And do you see it getting better, getting worse, neutral? What's your take on what's happening now?
Yeah. So I do absolutely address this in the book, because I, like you, actually, you know, I don't know if your upbringing was like this, but like I kind of, you know, became a teenager in the 1980s, which was which was a super anti-union moment as we were getting ready to adopt free trade, as we were getting ready to, you know, enact NAFTA. I mean, I feel like the entire decade was just a big old om ramp to Milton Friedman delights.
Yeah, great.
So, right? So yeah, of course, you know, in a lot of cultural depictions, like, unions are seen as bad. They slow things down. They make things expensive. They make working people feel entitled. How dare they? I mean, at the very least, I wish that we had labor history in schools.
Yeah. You know,
just give me like half a semester. Because our entire world, everything that we know about working in America would be absolutely completely different if it hadn't been for the organizing fervor of, you know, people late 19th century, early 20th century, and then obviously Franklin Roosevelt, people starting to be recognized as humans.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I am very hopeful about unions because so many people are unionizing now. And a lot of people who we didn't expect to unionize, like Amazon warehouse workers and graduate students.
Starbucks baristas.
I mean, here's the thing. The more America unionizes, the more we will, I believe, have compassion for each other as poor schmucks who are just trying to make a living and, you know, get it done. Seriously. For me, I think, and I talk a lot about community, but I mean, I really think this is it. You know, the whole bowling alone concept, the idea that we are a fractured society, that we are siloed, that we don't see ourselves and others. I blame that in part because, well, frankly, as a workforce, we are very fractured, but yeah. Unions, brotherhood, bring us together, sisterhood. You know, I thought it was really charming when I was working on, people are going to say charming, how's this charming? But I thought it was really charming when I was working on Into the Raging Sea, and I was hanging around with a lot of maritime union people, and they always ended their emails with, you know, in brotherhood, or your brother, or, you know, in solidarity. And it was like those little things. It sounds semantic, but it has tremendous, it's touching. It has tremendous meaning. And so I am hopeful that as more people unionize again, don't forget, like, this is the moment of, you know, since I guess 1930, this is the moment of the lowest representation in history of the United States. So in 90 years, we are now, I think, at 7% unionized in the United States. Do you know the moment when more Americans were unionized than any other? And do you know actually the percentage?
No, and I do not.
Okay. So don't quote me on this, but I think it was about 1968 to 1970. And I would say the peak unionization level was 33%.
I was going to guess a third. Okay.
Yeah. So like one out of three people was a member of a union, which meant that they were getting pulled into all kinds of interesting discussions about politics.
Yeah.
Right. And about their neighborhood. And about their city, and about, you know, thinking a lot larger about their place within this network. And so from a political standpoint, I mean, forget about the whole, you know, just it's better for everybody to be paid well, and, you know, have holidays and, you know, be able to take their kids to school or to the doctor if they're sick. The idea that, like, we can start to see ourselves and others.
Yeah. Yeah. Really? No, and it's interesting. Also, I think by being part of the union and participating in these things, you're getting information that isn't fucking bullshit.
Yes.
It's not Lauren Boebert saying, let's start with communists, you know.
That's right.
Or whatever.
Or it's the saying, church or evangelists.
Right. Yeah. It's saying, hey, if this happens, if the United States defaults on its loans, we're all fucked. Like, everybody on planet Earth is fucked forever, because they're just, the Chinese yuan is going to take over as the default currency for the free world. And that's it. We're just end the book on it. So, you know, these people are fucking evil, and that's, you know, that's what's happening. But it's not that now. The people don't have any source of information other than, like you say, some church, which is, you know, based on who knows what, certainly not economic drivers, which is what unions are based on primarily. And you know, and being able to say, if this policy is enacted, this is what is going to happen, this is what we anticipate will happen, therefore vote accordingly.
That's right. I mean it was just a tremendous source of good information to people who work, you know, and we have pretty much lost that. And I think that's probably what was most threatening to the Reaganites, mm-hmm. and the reactionaries, was that, oh my God, there's this network that we can't control, this network of information, you know, this strong political network that we absolutely have no control over, right? They wanted that to dissolve. And so they started to put out a lot of bad press about the unions. And of course, the unions were corrupted at moments. There was a lot of money going to pension funds. There still is. The pension funds in America are actually, I think, represent the largest chunk of money in the market, pension funds. It's funny, I was trying to get rights for a song to include the lyrics of the song in my book. And I had to track down who owned those rights. And I finally got to one of the largest rights owners in America. You know, they just bought up everybody and mm-hmm. everything. And so, and I was like, okay, well, who owns them? And wouldn't you know it, I believe it was the Minnesota Workers' Pension Fund, Minnesota State Pension Fund. Huh. They own, yeah, right? Yeah. I think a lot of people forget that when you're a union, you have these enormous pension funds, and they didn't just finance the construction of casinos in Cuba or, you know, Las Vegas.
Yeah.
There's a lot more work that pension funds do in the United States to secure capital and protect workers.
Well, I think that, you know, when we're talking about the dip in union membership and how it's as low as it's been, nothing is perhaps more symbolic of this than Ronald Reagan firing all of the air traffic controllers who were in in that union, and then them naming the fucking airport after him, you know, in DC. It's like, I don't know what the analogy there would be.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
You know, yeah.
I'll have to think about that. You know, a lot of people target that as a cultural touchstone. I've actually read different versions of that, and it turns out that the guy who was representing the air traffic controllers at that moment was fairly fresh in the job, fresh in the seat, and was maybe he might have been overstepping. Actually, he probably was. He was a fucking pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And you know, Reagan fired all those people. I'm not saying it didn't set off, you know, a whole series of events. It certainly signaled that, you know, the executive branch was no longer going to be sympathetic to organize people who are organized. But, you know, that specific example might not be a great one. But in any case,
I'm going to go with my basic law of everything, which is that Reagan is probably responsible if it's bad. There's no way. Yeah. It goes back to him in some capacity. So,
okay. Okay. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, it was a necessary step toward loosening up the chains so that we could pursue free trade. I mean, it had to happen. And that was very, very much top of mind on the agenda. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of my information. I got a lot of this particular information from Evil Geniuses by Kurt Anderson.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Yep. Great.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
He's been on the show.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Great. I love Kurt Anderson. Yeah. Co-founded Spy Magazine, which is the greatest thing ever.
So, right?
Yeah.
So worship, I don't know. Yeah, Kurt Anderson, but
absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the idea that there were, my position is that there was really nothing those guys wanted to do more than to ditch the unions, outsource manufacturing, and start up this whole global trade thing so that they could get absolutely fantastically rich. And I do believe that that's part of the reason that they started shifting workers away from pensions toward 401ks so that everybody would be invested in the market, so that even if people were making less, relatively speaking, and no longer had access to good like union manufacturing jobs, at least the market was doing well, and so their 401ks were going up.
Interesting, right? Because pensions are just it's just invested differently, right? Is that it's not?
Yeah,
you just get a certain amount of money based on your whatever it is, and
okay, yeah. And then there were people who managed pension funds, and some of them were better than others, and some of them really screwed over the unions. But in general, yeah, I mean, the idea was that a pension fund was tied to the stock market, but you were guaranteed a certain income when you got out. Now with everybody with 401ks, we all got thrown into the uncertainty of the market, but then it tied us to the market in a way that we would not have been before, is my point.
Yeah.
And so then we were desperate for all of these large corporations to make money by hook or by crook. whatever they needed to.
Or by, not even to make money, but for their stock price to go up, which is slightly different.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes. So.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for making that distinction.
Short-term gain always. Yes. Never any long-term anything. You know, nothing beyond next quarter going up, 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 up. Yeah. I mean, if you just invest all your money in Tesla, I think that's the thing to do. I mean, they're present. The guy's so
smart.
Oh,
is that your stock tip of the day?
Yeah. No, it is so not. I would steer clear. I used to have stock in Tesla. Yeah.
Like you actually called up a broker and said, buy me some Tesla.
No, I used E-Trade or whatever. But yeah, no, I bought like a couple of whatever, 8 shares of Tesla.
Oh, that's what people do now? Sorry, you can see how naive I am about it. Investing.
Yeah, my broker is E.F. Hutton, and he says, no, and I sold it when Elon Musk said he was going to take over Twitter.
And really?
Because I was like, it's over.
So
now.
That's what it took.
Yeah, because I knew it was going to fucking tank. He sucks. It's going to tank. Every once in a while, my research into fuckery pays off in some tangible way. We're talking very little amounts of money here, but you know.
So good to know. So funny story. Well, maybe not so funny, but you know, I'm a bike commuter. I used to bike a lot. And inevitably, if somebody was being super aggressive and trying to run you over, it was a black BMW. It was always a black BMW. I can't explain why. It was just the thing. But that has completely changed here. I live in Boston, so it's completely changed. And now if somebody's trying to run you over and being super aggressive, inevitably it's a Tesla.
Yeah, well, yeah, that makes sense. Also, you can't hear them because they make no noise. They're like stealthy.
Oh, you can hear them.
Oh, you can, okay, yeah.
You can hear that self-righteous, I'm driving an electric vehicle from like a mile away. But yeah, so there they are, like saving the world. Not really.
Not at all.
And at the same time, you know, with the very I'm driving a BMW attitude, which is like, I'm way more important than you, dearie. I have 4 wheels, you have 2.
Yeah. 4 wheels bad, 2 wheels good. That's animal farm for the.
I'll take 3 wheels.
I almost said Animal House, which is a totally different.
Which I've probably watched like 100 times.
Really? Me too. I've seen it so many times. Yeah, we used to watch it in college like almost every day. It's embarrassing how many times I've seen that movie. Like I don't.
It is embarrassing. I'm not embarrassed.
No, it's fucking great.
Like, guilty pleasure. It's so well done. And you keep seeing things in it. Right. It works on so many levels.
The best part is that he's, you know, that he's Bluto becomes a senator because, yeah, right. That's exactly what he is. Yeah.
That is exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. It's
Thank
perfect.
You, Bluto.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poor John Belushi. May
yeah. RIP. RIP, man. Okay. There's no easy segue from Animal House to China, but we're going to try to make it anyway.
I don't think you could.
I don't think I can. I don't think there's anything about that maybe one of the floats at the parade at the end is like vaguely Chinese themed and some
yes there is there's like a Mongolian
yeah it's probably
Mongolian maybe it's Genghis
they're like Khan. Shaking hands and then it breaks apart and D-Day comes out with the
oh my god sorry yes no it's yeah it's Genghis Khan I think and he goes over the fire hydrant and then okay anyway never mind if you haven't watched Animal House, just do it.
If you haven't watched Animal House, why are you listening to this? Turn us off and watch Animal House. Also, you know, one of the asshole bad guy frat boys' name is Greg, of course, because Greg is a bad guy name. I mean, you know, it just is. We've got Greg Abbott. It's Greg Jarrett. What's the guy's name? The Fox late night guy now, the horrible.
Oh, don't even ask me. I have no idea.
Greg Gutfeld. It's yeah.
Really? That's a name?
Yeah, there's not so many good Gregs. It's really frustrating for me.
Well,
so.
Look, you know, you'll be the first.
Yeah. okay, so China. What's your take on it in general about the trade deficits and stuff like that? Because you were talking before about Wilson's idea of how countries that trade together don't go to war. Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of applied that thinking to China because we owe them so much fucking money that what are they going to do? Take us out and then we can't pay them. It doesn't behoove them to do that in any way.
I mean, that's absolutely true. And I do believe that's kind of what's protecting us a bit. Well, first of all, I'm not in international politics. I'm not in the room where it happens, but I don't think China wants to go to war with anybody. But I do think that, you know, the Chinese have a responsibility to take care of their own, just like we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was this, I think there was bizarrely, and I'm just going to say it. I think there was a lot of in good faith stuff going on when we first gave China most favored status in 2002. I think probably it was based a little bit on racism, like how clever could the Chinese be, you know, that 50 years ago, or not even 30 years ago, they were mostly agrarian. So, you know, we'll just send some manufacturing over there and nobody will get hurt. And then the Chinese will always be beholden to us. I think that was the basic theory anyway. But, you know, the Chinese have pride in what they do and who they are in their incredible thousands and thousands year old culture. And I think they're taking care of business. They're taking care of themselves, which is what is driving in part my book and my examination of what's happening in America, because, well, we have a responsibility to take care of ourselves too. So one of the things that I sent you was that story about Chinese lending and building infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah. So they're going around and I talked about this on the podcast a couple weeks ago with John Fowler, the Australian former diplomat, about it's the Belt Road Initiative, where they just go and sign agreements with countries all over the place, mostly involving logistics and you know, things like that, so they can get raw materials from places. And as the article stated, and this is, you know, something they're doing, some of these countries take money from China, and we don't really even know what the usurious terms are of these loans, but they come due, and then, you know, what are we going to do? China generally has been less forgiving and less willing to compromise than, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, whatever, the Western-controlled financial outlets are. Not that they're any great picnic, by the way. You know, it's not like that's wonderful either. It's like, gee, should I go to Don Corleone or Barzini to get my money?
No, but at least they're concerned about optics.
Yeah, I can't decide which loan shark is gonna, you know, which leg is he gonna break?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you know, for the most part, what we're seeing is that these were very opportunistic deals that, you know, secured the power of leaders in the short term. And what's, I think, most evil, perhaps, is that, first of all, the infrastructure that was built for the most part on, you know, financed by these usurious loans, were to enable Chinese companies to extract raw materials from said country, right? So said country is paying Chinese companies to build the infrastructure that then Chinese use to their own benefit. And then it would help secure power in the short term for whatever administration is, like, you know, cutting these deals. And then that those people can leave, right? And that's really the problem with global capital in general, is that you can leave, right? So when we're talking about manufacturing, again, just bringing it back, you go into, this is a big problem right now. You go into Cambodia, you go into Vietnam, I'm talking about free-floating capital, and you set up all these structures to get people making things. And then when it becomes too expensive because people are organized or they expect more services or now they're more skilled, the capital moves on. There's no responsibility to nation. And so this is borderless capital. And, you know, the Chinese loans are essentially borderless loans. They're really only designed, as far as I can tell, to benefit ultimately the Chinese. And, you know, I'm going to be nice and I'm going to say, who can blame them? But it seems like we probably need a better system, but also Americans need to protect themselves as well. Just like we would be having very different conversations if our economy at this point weren't so completely intertwined with the Chinese economy. Not even the Chinese economy. We would be having a different conversation if we weren't so dependent on the Chinese goods, Chinese manufactured goods.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that's where I land with making it in America, is we can't even begin to be a world power, I think, in the sense that we would like to see ourselves, unless we have some capacity to make all the things that we use every day, not just chips, computer chips, you know, not just cars, but like everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And the pandemic, I think, really sort of brought that to bear, because you saw these shortages of strange things like pharmaceuticals.
One thing
like, oh my God, these are all made in India. Fuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, why is that made? You know, like you think something like that should be made in the United States. We'd want more controls over it, more rigorous controls over it. But no.
It was very sobering.
Yeah.
I mean, it was extremely sobering for lots of Americans to suddenly be confronted with shortages. Like, we'd never seen that before. And it wasn't shortages exactly. It was just that stuff wasn't able to get here. Like Chinese.
Yeah.
You know. But the whole thing about drugs, so I think you know Catherine Eban?
Mm-hmm. Eban.
Eban. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Eban. I'm going to try to remember that. Although it sounds like...
It doesn't sound like it should be pronounced that way, but that's how it's pronounced.
Yeah, but it also sounds like something that you would do to your kids to punish them for being on TikTok too long. They'd have an Eban.
Yeah. That's how you'll remember
it. That's how I'll remember it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Now I have a mnemonic.
Yeah, she's great. I love her. She's great work.
She's wonderful.
And she wrote the book. You're gonna the book about the pharmaceuticals. Yeah, the generic drugs. Yeah.
Yes, which I refer to. But yeah, Americans aren't used to not be having their, what is the latest thing now? I mean, it keeps making the front page of the New York Times. We don't have our ADHD drugs, right?
Yeah. No. Adderall. Yeah.
Adderall. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's an Adderall shortage in America, which. I don't know, it says a lot more about Americans than it does about manufacturing, that this is like a really big problem. I mean, forget about the cancer drugs and, you know, the transplant drugs and all those other things that for some reason we don't have, but get me some Adderall.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what are we going to do about it? So first of all, there are a lot of things that will be very difficult to do. And one of them that you touched on was just changing the culture around work.
Yeah.
Like, what kinds of work is acceptable? What kinds of work is actually desirable? What does it mean to be successful in America? What kinds of work do we want to do? You know, developing a different way to think about work and our relationship to work. I mentioned to you in my email that I'm starting to look more at this idea of trade schools.
Yeah.
So the other day, I met a woman who runs a private, built on a foundation trade school in Boston. And I was just like, I want to go there. I want to find out, what is this all about, a trade school? They give out, I think, a 2-year degree. And she was talking to me about how difficult this is. First of all, just to get financing for the students, because a lot of them are returning citizens, which means I hadn't heard that term before, but it means that they've spent some time as incarcerated people and now they're transitioning back into outside the walls.
Yeah.
And they're looking, you know, for focus. And you've got some kids straight out of high school, but then you have a lot of kids also who were like in the service industry or maybe driving the Uber or, you know, making coffee. And they wanted some skills. They wanted to participate in something that required more. And so they're going back. And what the they're going to these trade schools. So what do trade schools teach? And how do they decide what they're going to teach?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they've always had a strong connection to industry. But recently, you know, in the past like 30 years, because there's so much less industry, those connections have been somewhat broken. And now there are new leaders stepping forward to run these schools, to reach out to industry, all kinds of industry, and say, hey, what do you need?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you need? What do you need Americans to do now? And so these schools, I think, will be the beginning of a different kind of America. So in that school, they're teaching green energy, for example. So they're teaching students, obviously, electrical engineering, but the hands-on kind of electrical mm-hmm. engineering. For a long time, most of that was about servicing, you know, HVAC systems, so heating, yep. heating and cooling systems, refrigerants, that sort of thing. But they're doing that, but at the same time, they're shifting some of the best students over to learning how to service turbines and how to lay down the electrical infrastructure and repair the electrical infrastructure to be able to really, really, really build a green economy, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But, you know, what industry needs is not necessarily apparent. And so the leaders of a lot of these schools have to do a lot of the work themselves, you know, like look out there, reach out to people. These are phone calls. These are phone calls from like a president of a small trade school in Boston to General Dynamics or, you know, some other large corporation just saying, who can I talk to? What do you guys need? And this is all really important stuff because I think the other article that I sent
about
you,
the semiconductors, because Biden, you know, we've shut that down in China. We don't want China making the computer chips anymore. But if they're not going to make them, we have to make them. And who's going to make them? And there's a shortage, you know, there's a labor shortage of people that know how to do that. And there's factories being built across the United States in various places. And they're going to need people that know how to do that, you know, which is not going to be yeah. me because I don't know how to do it. I wouldn't know the first thing about it. I would
know
lithium.
Send you to trade school. Yeah. But yeah, so the idea is like a lot of this stuff is going to be automated. And so we also need people at every level who understand robotics and programming and servicing these machines as well. I mean, even as things become more automated, we're going to need people who understand things. And the factory built in some place in Arizona, first of all, super bad idea. Like we should be building manufacturing around cities where there are concentrations of populations.
And lots of commercial real estate that's just sitting vacant, by the way. Just, you know, just throwing that out there. Lots of space now in these cities.
You're talking about the office buildings?
Yeah. Just everywhere. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're rich in public transportation and we're rich in space. And you could actually manufacture down in downtown Boston at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. You saw those articles about how much empty space is in the city. And so instead, I just don't understand this approach is just like find a virgin spot somewhere, you know, outside of some car dependent city in Arizona, build a factory and then hope people will come.
Right. In a place where that's there's not going to be any crazy. Water in 10 years. It's a great idea. Yeah. Not,
I mean, well, obviously, yes. So yeah, so it's interesting because in my conclusion to Making It in America, I talk about how difficult it is to manufacture here ethically. Right? It's expensive.
Yeah.
But one of the key ingredients to manufacturing successfully is locating your factory in a place where you have workers who are looking for that kind of work. I mean, this yep. is fundamental, right? This is like business 101. Workers who are looking for that kind of work, and there isn't too much competition for their labor so that you can keep prices fairly reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Duh, that's yeah, pretty much yeah. the beginning and end of it, right? So basically the United States needs an entire rethink about our industrial policy. And it's going to be about schools, and it's going to be about how do we zone and locate these factories. And it's going to be about, you know, unionizing so that you know, union shops take care of union shops. So we start to rebuild networks, supply networks, and people networks and political networks that will, you know, boost this system that I think we desperately need.
It sounds like people are working on it. It sounds like people know what to do. So I feel more hopeful having talked to you than I did while I was preparing the questions to ask you, I have to say, because it seems like, you know, the economics are such that, so, you know, it's not even the 1%. It's this tiny group of people control so much fucking money and are so reluctant and have gamed the system to such a degree that they're never going to get rid of it. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned evil geniuses. If you go and read about these little foundations that are basically funding all of this right-wing fuckery, 9 times out of 10, it's a fortune that somebody inherited, and the rich person signing the check got their money from dad. It's not somebody usually that did it themselves, you know? So it's this person whose wealth probably should have been taken a lot of it away. It's a walking argument for the fucking estate tax is what it is. You know, these Koch brothers, that they need, you know, pay the money to the government, guys. That's it. And at a certain point, historically speaking, there's this thing, and I'm not an economist by any means, but there's that the Lorenz curve, which plots basically income inequality. Right. And when it bulges too much and too much capital gets tied up in too few hands, there is always revolution. Always, always, right. Always. It doesn't ever not happen. So it behooves everybody for them to pay up a little bit more tax to avoid this sort of catastrophe.
And, yeah, but, you know, I would refute that. Mm-hmm. Because these days, I mean, we were talking about borderless capital, and we're talking about the billionaire class that really has no allegiance to any particular country anymore. So I don't think that that's a factor in their decision making process anymore.
No. Lock them send them the fuck out then, you know?
Well, I mean, let's call it what it is. It's wealth hoarding.
Yeah.
And you know, and it comes out of, you said anything that Reagan did wasn't good. I mean, part of what he did was, you know, help us all get there, right? All think that, like, wealth was a great thing. And
greed is,
that's
good.
That's what we all, yeah, and that's what we had to aspire to, was to be wealthy. I'll leave you with this. One of my favorite research papers of all time. If anybody, everybody must have their favorite research paper.
That's
right?
It. Now you have to write Rachel Slade's top 10 research papers of all time. Okay.
Great. Okay. So one of my favorite research papers of all time. Now, this was many years ago that I read it, but I cite it all the time and I still think it's fascinating. So there was a school in New York City, and it was a publicly funded school, I think. And the only requirement for getting in was that you had to have an IQ above something like 130 or 140, whatever it was. So they were only pulling in kids who could pass this IQ test, whatever you think about it, with flying colors. So in theory, this was a pretty smart bunch of kids. Right. Mm-hmm. I want to get into the IQ.
Yeah, no. Let's just
take that at face value.
Yeah.
So after about 20 years, a researcher was very interested in what happened to all these really intelligent kids. What, when they, you know, left the school and went into the workforce and blah, 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 like, what happened to them? So I'm curious, what do you think happened to them?
They got their lunch money taken, I think is what happened to them. You know, the problem is that intelligence is so varied along different lines. I mean, I might have said this before on the podcast. I went to high school with somebody who got a perfect score on the SAT. And I had to explain to this person, when a bunch of us went to the pizzeria, that it was actually more cost effective to order one pizza and split it than to just order slices. Like, the brain just didn't go there. Because it was a practical way of thinking about it. And she was so lofty, you know, which is, she's very, very smart, but lacked the certain street smarts, you know? So there's different kinds of intelligence is my point. She probably would have aced the, I'm sure her IQ is super high, but you know, not everybody with a high IQ could do very basic practical things. Remember on the West Wing, there's a thing about the West Wing where it's season two and they're out campaigning and they get stuck. Like Josh and Toby get stuck somewhere in Indiana.
Oh yeah. With,
what's her name? The you know, Josh's love interest.
Yeah.
God, I can't remember her name on the Donna. Is right. There with them. And the president says, he hangs up the phone and he's like, 300 IQ points between them, and if Donna wasn't there, they would have to buy a house. And that's, you know, that's the thing. So anyway.
All right. So Greg's sample of one and West Wing, Greg has concluded that these people could not function in society, or they'd have trouble functioning well in society. So
I think that it's probably going to be less of a high success rate than maybe the school would have hoped for. That's my guess.
Okay. So the answer is wrong.
Ugh.
They were comfortably middle upper class, all of them, for the most part. I mean, they figured out how to have a life with work-life balance. So they had families, they had work, they weren't crazy about the work because they didn't need any validation through material gain, but they had a very strong understanding of how much you did need to, you know, be comfortable. And that's what they shot for. So they found jobs that gave them a certain level of satisfaction and a certain amount of income where they didn't have to work too hard for it. In other words, they didn't need that validation.
Yeah.
Right? That a lot of these like Elon Musk types for some reason feel that they do. So I'm not saying that if you're a billionaire, that should be a good tip off that you have an average IQ. I'm not saying that. I'm definitely not saying that.
Oh, I'll say it. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely your moral IQ is very low. I mean,
yeah, your moral IQ, absolutely. Yeah, you got to be ruthless. But also just the idea that is something that somebody would want. It's sort of like, you know, when you were a kid and somebody would say, and you would say to, I don't know, your grandpa, I want to be president of the United States. And grandpa, if he was smart, would say, oh, no, you don't. Like, that's a tough job.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I would hope that a sign of intelligence is just figuring out how to make it work without too much trouble.
You would think. Yeah.
Well, that's why I love this. I love this little piece of research so much, because we live on a stunning planet. As far as I'm concerned, the best one out there. I don't want to go to Mars.
It's the best one I've been to.
Right?
Yeah.
I have no desire to, you know, get moon dust all over me or, you know, in the gears of my bike. Like, no, this planet is a fucking miracle. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like the best life is the one where you work and you have time to go home and you have time to enjoy this beautiful place that we're in.
That's it. That's what it's all about. I agree. Yeah. I think that's the way to go. And, you know, I want to say a quick Elon Musk thing, because I actually had written this down in the article about in the Times about the Chinese debt program. Zambia owes like $6 billion in debt. That's what they owe. The country of Zambia in Southern Africa. Elon Musk paid what, $44 billion for Twitter? Like, he could theoretically just write a check and clear their debt.
Well, probably Putin paid that.
I know. Well, let's just assume he has some control over the money here, which I know that's a wild assumption, but like, it's not that much money is my point. If you're one of these super uber wealthy people, and it's like, probably wouldn't even occur to anybody to do something like that. So
to bail out Zambia, you want Elon Musk to bail out Zambia?
Yeah. Why not? Bail out Zambia. Do something nice for some people. Do something good for society. You know, he's practically from there. Isn't there an emerald mine there that his father, you know, exploited? Come on.
For fuck's sake, I'm sure. Well, I mean, you know, that's the whole thing about the Democratic Republic of Congo, is that we've talked about this before, but obviously that's where all these minerals are coming from that you need to make the batteries. And so, you know, who owns Congo is basically the billionaire class.
Yeah.
So why would he want to bail out Zambia when it could be possibly the next Congo?
Just then he might
make people just indebted to you, and the riches will come to you.
I don't know. It just seems like, you know, it's that level of thing. But I think it also speaks to the disparity of wealth, you know, that a nation should have that kind of debt load that an individual could pay off is insane, I think, right, in this day and age. There has to be some better way to shake up the system. And I don't know what it is, because every time there's some kind of, you know, we have to, you know, seize the means of production, then it cuts to, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene bitching about communism. And I don't know. I think that you're the way that you ended it is right. I think that the thing to do is to make enough money to live, you know, fairly comfortably. And that's really all that you require. I mean, there's no, even this, like Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller gave most of his money away because he was like, what am I going to do with it? You know? And
thank God he did.
You know, I have enough I'm going to pay what I need to do the things. Guy went golfing every day, no matter what, even if it snowed, he hired people to clear it out, you know, so he could get his golf game in.
So I would say that that's a smart person, although he was very not nice to steel workers, but or oil workers, but you know, when it came to labor, he wasn't great. But
No, you know the story about his daughter going to buy furniture. Yeah, this is it. We're gonna end after the
okay.
She went to go buy furniture at some store in Lower Manhattan. I think he was getting married or something, and they, you know, she went to the store. She's like, well, I don't have money with me, but I'm going to pay on credit. And they're like, who are you? And she's like, I'm Rockefeller. And they were like, yeah, just buy whatever you want. You know, your credit's fine. But she didn't know, because he didn't tell them how rich he was. He didn't want his kids to be spoiled assholes. So he intentionally hid it as much as he could from his own children. And she didn't realize how loaded he was until she went furniture shopping, and she was like, you know, when she was 25 or so, you know, however old she was. So,
oh, that's fascinating.
Yes, there is an intelligence to them. Yeah.
And I'm sure all of that furniture was made in the US at the time.
Abso-fucking-lutely. Yeah.
Right. Something that I always look for. I mean, actually, until recently, most of the furniture was, a lot of the furniture was made in this. I'm talking about big stuff, just because it was so expensive logistically
to ship it. Yeah.
But that is definitely changing.
No, it's IKEA. It's the curse of IKEA.
Oof, IKEA. Yeah. Well, that's very fabulous. I'm happy for Rockefeller Jr.
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember her name. It's Ethel. I want to say it's Ethel. I thought it began with an E.
Eban.
Your book is called Making It in America. You can go right now and pre-order it on Amazon, which you should absolutely do. Where can we find you? What's your tweet? Are you still on Twitter, or you've
abandoned it? I gave up the Twitter.
You did?
You can find my, I did. I mean, just for the same reason that you sold your Tesla stock, which I'm sure broke Elon Musk's heart. He was like, no.
Yeah.
I thought he was evil like us. He has an evil name.
Yeah.
That's how Musk knew it was over. But
that's why he's so pissed off now. It's all my fault. Yeah. Yeah.
It's probably you. That makes a lot of sense, actually. So my website is rachelslade.net. And if anybody wants to reach out to me, there's a little form there. And tell me how wrong I am. Or if you're a really nice person, tell me how right I am.
I think people will tend to agree with me that you're right. You know, you've been right most of the time. You've been right most of the time. So, Rachel Slade, great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fossa. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Kost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.